So the Buddha said there's four ways that we cause suffering in our lives through attachment to things. The first is, I'm only going to talk about one tonight. The first is kama upadama, which is basically we're attached to things that make us feel good. We like to be around sexy, attractive, funny people. If you turn on your TV set, that's all you're going to see. You'll see once in a while a character actor thrown in just to add some acting chops to any show, but most of the time it'll just be a bunch of pretty young people. That's what we like, things that taste delicious, that make us feel really good, drugs and alcohol, things that take away the edge, just attachment to sensual pleasures. And of course, as a lasting strategy for happiness, this doesn't work very well because things change, our tolerance grows, and it doesn't work as a strategy for feeling peace inside, trying to, consume. Consuming only gives very short-term happiness. So the second thing we cling to is views and opinions about the world. This is sila upadana, and you don't have to know the Pali terms. I just like to trot it out because it makes me look impressive. Noah always gets on my case about using the Pali book. Fuck it. So, and that's just, we all have views and opinions about the way the world should be, politics, culture, what's your favorite movie, why, Ben Affleck sucks as an actor, but he's a good director, I don't know, whatever the fuck our opinions are. I don't generally stick to my opinions that much, except, every 4 years when there's an election, I always get in fights with close friends, because my close friends are always, there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, fuck this shit, and I'm always like, no, there is a difference, blah, 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 blah. And it's the same shit, every fucking 4 years. And I attach to that, because I grew up in one of those families that just abhorred Republicans. So I bring suffering into my life by that attachment. And but thankfully, I take a lot of my tastes with a grain of salt. Sometimes not. I've gotten into arguments about how much I love Breaking Bad and stuff like that. But not too many, fortunately. So anyway, obviously when we stick and clutch and cling to our opinions, it brings us into conflict with people who feel differently. If I love Meshuggah and Mastodon and you can't stand them, if I cling to it, then we're going to have a struggle. So it's best not to hold on to them too tightly. So the third is sila upadama, which is clinging we have to our habits, our rituals, the things we like to do. I want my iced coffee in the fucking morning. I go through, every time I go throughout Europe, it's just me versus Europe. I have no clue. They know they have Starbucks, so now finally they've gotten the idea. But for me, it was like, you take the fucking ice and put it in the fucking coffee. In Scotland, they were just like that. It was as if I was bringing a revolution to them. So, obviously, if we cling to things, then when things change, if we have a favorite restaurant, it's not there anymore. If we have a favorite seat in Dharmapunks, and then that cushion's taken. If we have anything that is habitually dictated, can cause suffering if it's interrupted. So it's best again to experiment with changing things up. But tonight what I'm going to talk about is the fourth kind of clinging, and this is the one that the Buddha said caused not only the most suffering in life, but also is the form of clinging that he said that Buddhism which the, his views on this fourth kind of clinging is what separates Buddhism from every other spiritual path. And that's identity views. Attava dupadana. Such a terrible word. Attava dupadana. He also called it Sakaya Ditti. Basically, what it means is we all have views on what makes us unique, a personality, what gives us an identity that's different from everybody else, which an identity that stays consistent throughout the course of our lives. And this identity view, this story we carry in our heads about who we are, is a source of suffering and stress and confusion. And so tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about it and what the Buddha brought to the table and ways we can escape. Of course, I talk about this a lot, so each time I talk about it, I try to bring a new approach to dealing with identity view. So, in general, when people ask us about ourselves, suppose, God forbid, you're out on a date or something. This would be a strange place to be out on a date. So, I mean, but suppose you were and you're talking about yourself. Most people don't talk about the things that make them similar to everybody else. We talk about the things that make us stand out. You know, you don't say, oh, I'm a basically consistent driver. Like, what the fuck are you telling me that? Yeah. I like chocolate. I wake up in the morning. I fall asleep at night. Take a shower. I'm good at showering. And wash my body pretty consistently. I do the left, the right, the front, and the back. You know, it's the whole thing. I've got down pretty well. Nobody would do that because. In the mundane world of interpersonal relationships and especially careers, and we like to keep track of what sets us apart, what unique abilities we have, and so we tend to carry around in our minds the story about why I am different, why I am special. And so rather than focusing on the core experiences that we all share, the mind tends to focus on these differentiations, the things that separate us, and it can cause a lot of different kinds of suffering. I'll just list a few. The first is that if I have an identity view about myself, a story that I tell about myself, I'll feel pretty trapped with it. I'll feel pretty stuck with it. For example, I remember when I, up until the time I was in my 20s, and up until the time you're in your 20s, you have no clue that you're mortal. You do stupid, fucked up shit. But then one day you wake up, you're like, oh my God, you know, I'm going to die. And it seemed that very day I had that, I had to go on an airplane. I was terrified. You know, it was like choppy weather, you know, and it had that kind of stuff going on, turbulence. And so having this fear, I said, oh my God, I'm frightened of flying. I have fear of flying. And this was the first time. It had never happened before, but I made this statement in my mind. The next time I got on a plane, I remember very well, I was just sitting there and enjoying the flight, and then I had this thought, oh, wait, I'm frightened of flying. And it triggered this contraction, and my breath got shallow, and I started to hyperventilate, and I started to sweat, and I started to get nervous, and then it began to ingrain that story. And so I took something that was not in any way part of who I was, and simply by making the statement, I am this, I added that story to each time I would fly. There'd be this memory where I'd go on the plane, and then there'd be this moment where it's fine, and then there'd be this sudden recognition, oh, and then it would happen even before I got on the plane. And so I finally had to get to a place where I realized, well, the problem here is not that there's anything inherently that I have a fear of flying. It's just this is a story that I tell that creates panic. And I have to tell the story to myself that I don't fear flying and that there was many, many years when I didn't. And actually that I began to let go of that fear by remembering what it felt like before I added that story. So we carry around these things and they become like heavy suitcases we're carrying around. I'm good at this, I'm bad at that. People, when they go into jobs, they really narrowly define what it is they think they have the right to do. In this country, nobody feels they have the right to sing. You ever notice that? I went through Ireland when I was a kid. You go around pubs, every fucker was singing. It was great. You know, like an Oasis song would come up and the entire bar would be like, don't look back. And I have no idea of anger, you know, whatever. What's an Oasis song? Anyway, they would sing the shit. You know, I don't even like Oasis, but they would sing it. It was kind of nice, right? So here, if you start singing in a bar, people would go, what? You a fucking singer or what? You know, sorry. So anyway, we have these things that we feel that we can do and we can't do, and we only give ourselves permission to do the things that we feel that we are uniquely good at. If we don't feel that we could be a good skateboarder, we don't buy a skateboard. We don't feel we can be a terrific guitarist, we don't buy a guitar. We're very much caught up in this. We only can do something if we're going to be distinctly very good at it, above the pack. We're not allowed to just enjoy doing shit that everybody else, you know, might enjoy doing. There's this idea that we cling to these things that set us apart. And it's a lot of storytelling we have to carry around. The Buddha called it kriya, mental agitation. All these things I carry around, you know, if you go on a job interview and you're just, nobody likes job interviews, but if you're in a job interview, it's one thing, but if you add the story, oh, I suck at this, then it makes it much harder. And then if you carry on, the last 5 times I was in a job interview, it really sucked. Then it makes it that much harder. So all the stories we carry around become mental weight. And then on top of it, the more details about our lives and backstory and self-justifications we carry around, the more it obscures very often simple solutions to our problems, our challenges. For example, we're in a job we hate, right? But we also have to pay the rent. So what do? Well, if we just look at it like that, we can say, okay, which voice do I want to empower? The voice of fear, I have to pay the rent, I have to pay the rent, or the voice of I deserve to be happy, and we can just make that decision. Fuck this job. I'll get a job that doesn't suck as bad. But no, we don't. We carry all this other stuff. but I might never get another job. And my mother said that I should always stick with jobs until I get another job. And my friend, they didn't find it that easy. And that might happen to me. And then I won't be able to eat. And blah, blah, blah. And then we just carry around and we add self-identity view. And I'm a fraud. And I'll never get another job. And it becomes more and more difficult to simply take care of ourselves. It traps us. So, most importantly, it makes us feel isolated. When we feel that what we're experiencing is unique or ours alone, about us, not only does it feel like everything is happening to us, we're being punished, I'm the only one that feels heartache, I'm the only one that's been rejected, when all these things are universal. Everybody experiences heartache, breakups, rejections, abandonments. That's called being human. But we all take it personally. Oh my God, I had a relationship, it didn't work out. It's painful, but it's not about us. This is what it means to be born into a human birth. So when we feel, though, that it's that our suffering is unique, our story is, you know, especially ours, when we get caught up in the details, then we don't feel we have the permission to share. And when we don't share about it, when we don't talk about it, it further ingrains this isolation and uniqueness. It's only by connecting with others that we really experience that what we're going through is not unique, is not specially about us. The more we feel alone and like our disappointments and our setbacks are about us, the more painful they become. For example, I had a friend who, I'm going to go back to the story, but I have a friend who was terrified of going to the dentist to get a cavity filled. And he really felt that he was the only one that had fear of the dentist and that he was frightened of pain and he was ashamed. I had another friend who, in 12-step practice, you do things called 4 steps and 5 steps where you talk about things that you're specifically ashamed of. And this guy has long since moved across country. You'll never find out who he is, so I can completely share his secret with you. He was terrified to admit one thing. He has carried around this ball of shame in his entire life. And he made me promise on a stack of Bibles, practically, that I would never repeat it to anyone. So here I go. He had this huge shame that he had, in a bar, at one point in his life, made out with a transvestite. I think maybe he got a hand job. But anyway. I looked at him after that's it? I mean, that was the most interesting thing about this guy. I was like, this thing that you're carrying around as this huge shame is the, I didn't say this, but it's the first thing that this is great. This is wonderful. He was he was shocked. Because he was growing up in a Catholic family, and this meant horrible things that he got hand dropped from a transvestite. So anyway, so this is what happens when we don't share, we don't open up, when we take our experience as unique. It becomes shame. It grows way out of proportion. I'm the only one who stole money from my parents when I was a kid to buy pot. I'm the only one. So obviously it's essential to break through this. Now, the Buddha, this is where it gets interesting. The Buddha was, up until he was in his 20s, he was pretty much hidden away from the world by his father. He was in a castle, and he didn't really see a lot of the sufferings that everybody goes through in life. And so when he finally got out of the castle and went amongst the people, and he saw the poverty and the aging and the sickness and death and the misery that's transpersonal, he really saw that suffering is universal. It happens to everyone. The Buddha could be compared with what's known as a structuralist. He didn't think that suffering is about details, that our suffering is about the special things that happen to us. He said that the things that cause and release us from, the things that cause our suffering and the things that release us from it are transpersonal, they're ahistorical, they happen to everyone in every culture throughout history. So there's nothing unique about our suffering. There's nothing unique about what causes us misery. The whole point of the word noble in the Four Noble Truths is that they are completely universal. Everything about suffering is universal. So the Buddha, even more so when he saw suffering, he became shocked that he had such a visceral shuddering at first at the experience of something that was so universal going to happen to everyone. Everybody is going to grow old. Everybody is going to sicken. Everyone is going to experience fear. Everyone's going to experience confusion. Everyone's going to experience being separated from the loved and being united with people we don't like. That happens to everyone. That's what the cause of, that's what the first noble truth is that suffering is universal to everybody. It's not personal. The second is that what causes the greatest amount of suffering in our life aren't the universal things that, aren't the universal setbacks, but the universal way we try to avoid those setbacks. Everybody tries to avoid growing old. Everybody tries to avoid what's unpleasant. Everybody tries to avoid the inevitable. We all try to cling to things that give us the illusion that we will never have to experience loneliness. We all try to get as many Facebook friends as possible and as many likes. So I'm going to send out this thing that everybody will like because that way I'll never be alone. I'll never experience loneliness. I'll never, that's not what we think, but that's the underlying motivation, which is we all want to avoid boredom, loneliness, the feeling of being vulnerable. We all want to and we have the same strategies. We seek approval. We seek material gain to make us feel secure. We seek fame and recognition. We seek things that make us stand out because we believe that that's the way that we will be safe from the inevitable loneliness, the inevitable feelings of not being loved. So the Buddha brought this belief that if we let go of the details about our life and we simply go into the core, the universal experience, we can begin to see a way out. The thing that keeps us stuck in our suffering, what's known as samsara, the cycle of repetitive clutching and clinging onto things that give us the illusion that they'll bring us lasting happiness and then don't, is by letting go of all the things that we muddy up the story with and just go to the core, which everybody can identify with, and to simplify the way we look at our lives so that we see what's the most important things to focus on. So, I'll give you some examples of how we do this. The most important practice when in life, when we are in a situation, is to ask ourselves, or to remind ourselves, okay, I know it seems like this situation is mine alone, but what am I going through that anybody could relate to, identify with? When we share about it, focus on the details of how we feel and what our actions are. Those are the keys. Suppose we're in a breakup. We've met somebody, we love them, they're terrific, it seems like the one. Then inexplicably it falls apart. We feel completely damaged, there's something wrong with us, we'll never get in a good relationship again. So we can get caught up in how great the person was and how miserable we feel, and we can get caught up in the idea that nobody can understand the feeling of rejection or things falling apart. On the other hand, if we simply tell the story as, I met somebody, I thought this was the one, I got very excited, we were together all the time, and then it didn't work out, and now I feel miserable, and I let go of all my connections with my friends while I was in this relationship, then we can see, oh, the actions were I let my life get completely out of balance. I threw everything into the relationship. I stopped connecting with people, I stopped doing my art, I stopped taking care of myself with my yoga or whatever. I threw everything into the relationship, and because I brought all of this attention to it, it imploded. If we don't get lost in the details of who said what, who was right, who was wrong, and we simply look at it from an overview, then we can learn something. So the next time we are in a relationship, we don't allow our lives to get completely imbalanced. We don't allow the other parts of our lives, the exercise, the creativity, the friendships, the other endeavors to fall by the wayside. And we can learn from that. When we listen to people, it's really, really essential to listen for the emotions and the feelings that we can identify with and put aside the details about their story that we feel are either silly or extreme. For example, my friend who was frightened of going to the dentist for the cavities, when I listened to him, I put aside that story about the cavities and I just thought, okay, here's a person who's going through something they haven't done before and they're frightened. Can I relate to that? Of course I can. That's a human experience. If I listen that way, then I can say to him, okay, when I go through something new that I haven't done before and is frightening, I try to not guess and speculate about how it will be. I try to work with the breath and relax myself. I try to ask other people who've been through something similar what it was like so I can demystify it. But if I get caught up in the detail, oh, he's just getting a cavity, then I can't learn anything from the experience. I can't help him. I can't build a bridge. I can't myself feel like, oh, here's another example of fear of the unknown. So the more I let go of those details and simply go into the emotion and the action, then I can begin to bridge and find the universal. When I do that, then I can see solutions. For example, again, looking at that situation where I'm in a job that sucks and I'm frightened of quitting it because I have to pay the rent and I have expenses. If I get caught up in how many expenses I have and how this job is really a blessing and how and all those stories about, oh, I'm a fraud, and I'll never get another job, then I'll be stuck. But if I simply look at it in terms of here's one voice that's fear, and here's another voice that's about taking care of myself, then I can see, okay, just with that simple view, I can say, okay, which voice in my mind do I want to empower? Do I want to empower fear by staying in the job and the belief that I can never get another one? Or do I want to empower adventurousness and risk-taking and taking care of myself? Then I can make a decision. Right, let me see if I have any. It's really important when we review life to clear out the greatest fog, and that's called self-justification. We all have it when we do something that causes what the Buddha calls unease, samvega. We all tend to immediately jump into self-defense. As I was saying, I talked about it last week. When I was a kid, I would, when my mom would come home, she'd have this big, wonderful bags. And my mom was neurotic. And she would crumple the money into balls and just throw it in her wallet because she was nervous. And she didn't really care that much, and she'd leave it out on the couch. And I was a 12-year-old pothead, and there was crumpled up $10 bills, which was, it so happened, the exact amount that I needed. And I go in, and I grab the crumpled up $10 bill, and I go out, and I buy a bag of pot. And the moment that unease would come up, I would immediately justify, well, they're shitty parents. My dad's an alcoholic. Fuck them. I deserve this pot. If you grew up in my family, you would need pot too. And the 12-year-old judge in my mind was okay with his logic. It was like, boom, innocent. And as we grow older, the defense attorney in my mind becomes even more sophisticated. Yes, I stole those pens from that advertising agency because they don't need those pens, etc. What we don't see is it begins to obscure the very simple equation of when I take this action, it gives birth to unease. That's all I need to see. Because when I cover it up with self-justification for a long time, what I don't notice is that my self-esteem is lowering. If I'm stealing, if I'm taking, if I'm lying, if I'm distorting the truth, if I cover it up with self-justification, it's covering up the fact that slowly my self-esteem and my inner worth is eroding. And I don't get to see the relationship between the simple action and the simple result, which is I don't feel comfortable with that action. I immediately make the discomfort go away, which is the result of the action, and that obscures the learning. So it's really essential to let go of the background details of why we do something. It doesn't matter if somebody else is 99% in the wrong. The focus is on what the action is and what the result is. That's what the Buddha called karma. If we want to grow, if we want to navigate through life, that's the way we begin to get a clear, precise picture of how we cause our own suffering. So I think, actually, that's enough for tonight. As usual, I always prepare more than I need to talk about. So I think you get the idea that it's helpful in life to let go of all the background justifications and details and the uniqueness, and to, at times, even if we're going through a difficult situation in life, even view it as if somebody else was telling the story to us. I'm not frightened of the things that make you terrified. You're not frightened of the things that make me terrified. So often, if we just let go of the details and focus on keeping the story as an overview, share, listen in the same way, we can get to a place where we no longer experience anything in our lives as personal or uniquely ours. And when we do that, we no longer feel alone in any way. We feel connected. So thanks. Hope there was something there. And I'm going to turn this off. And so...